From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how Iraq was created after World War I when the victors redrew the map of the Arab world. Temporary control of the country was given to the British. The Iraqis rebelled. We talk with Margaret McMillan, author of the book Paris 1919, 6 months that changed the world. It's about the Paris Peace Conference. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews Amandla, a documentary about protest music in the black townships of South Africa during the apartheid years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Representatives of Iraq's ethnic and political groups will hold a national conference within the next month to decide on an interim government. They reached the agreement at a U.S.-sponsored meeting today in Baghdad. NPR's Guy Raz reports that Iraq's ethnic groups were widely represented, with some notable exceptions.
The two leading Kurdish figures, Masoud Barzani of the Kurdistan Democratic Party and Jalal Talabani of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, did not attend the talks. There were other Kurdish leaders there today. Some prominent Shia leaders from southern Iraq did not attend the talks. But at the same time, representatives from the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq did attend. That's an Iraqi opposition group that's been based in Iran for the past several years. They did attend the talks. They boycotted a previous meeting that was held in the southern city of Ur earlier this month. U.S. officials were very much encouraged that a delegate from that group did attend the talks.
NPR's Guy Raz. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the United States is studying a proposal put forward by North Korea during a series of talks last week in Beijing. Powell said the North Koreans acknowledged their nuclear weapons capability and their missile activities and offered a plan that would address U.S. concerns. He added that the communist nation expects something considerable in return. The Bush administration has cut off fuel shipments to North Korea to protest its continued development of nuclear weapons in violation of an earlier agreement. The administration has said it would not reward North Korea for bad behavior by restoring those shipments unless the North gives up its nuclear activities. The World Health Organization says the worst of the SARS outbreaks in Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Vietnam are over. The WHO travel advisory for Vietnam has now been lifted. Dan Karpinchuk reports Canadian officials are trying to convince the World Health Body to lift the advisory for Toronto.
The World Health Organization says SARS has peaked in those countries, but that doesn't mean the travel warning will automatically be lifted everywhere. David Heyman, the WHO's chief of communicable diseases, says it appears that in Canada, transmissions of SARS have stopped completely. The virus has killed 21 people, all of them in Toronto. And the travel advisory has staggered the city's tourism industry with cancelled conventions, tour groups, and concerts. Air and bus travel, hotels, restaurants, and even retail shops are also reporting that business is down. The medical officer of health for Ontario has been trying to convince WHO officials to lift the travel advisory, saying it was unwarranted. And today, Ontario's Minister of Health is on his way to Geneva to add his weight to the argument, saying if he can sway the debate even a bit, it would be worth it. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
In stocks, the Dow gained 165 points to close at 8471. The Nasdaq gained 27. This is NPR News. Israel has dismantled an unauthorized settlement outpost in the West Bank. The removal of a second outpost was delayed by a petition to the Israeli Supreme Court. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The unauthorized settlement outpost that was dismantled was unpopulated, with only a mock antenna and a large cargo container near an Israeli military base in the West Bank. The dismantling of a second outpost near the West Bank city of Hebron was delayed after the father of an Israeli security guard, who was killed when Israeli soldiers mistook him for a terrorist, appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court. Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz told Sunday's cabinet meeting that all unauthorized outposts will be evacuated evacuated by the army. Defense officials say there are about 70 outposts, many of them unpopulated, but that only some of them are unauthorized. The left-wing Peace Now movement says there are more than 100 outposts, many of them set up under Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's government. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Federal regulators have announced the final terms of a $1.4 billion settlement with 10 of Wall Street's biggest brokerage firms. Richard Grasso, head of the New York Stock Exchange, said the deal could help restore confidence on Wall Street.
Investors do not expect a guarantee of profit. However, they expect, deserve, and the financial community must deliver a guarantee of fairness.
The Securities and Exchange Commission accused the firms of deceptively promoting certain stocks in companies that they were courting as investment banking clients. None of the brokerages admitted wrongdoing. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Online Shop features All Songs Considered, the CD series based on the music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you want to understand contemporary Iraq, you have to consider its past. The country was created in the aftermath of World War I as part of the peace treaty in which the victors divided up the land they conquered. The conquered land included the Arab territories of the Ottoman Empire, which stretched from Turkey to Saudi Arabia and from Iraq to North Africa. My guest, Margaret McMillan, is the author of the book Paris 1919, 6 Months That Changed the World. She's also the author of Women of the Raj and Canada and NATO. She's provost of Trinity College and professor of history at the University of Toronto. Before we talk about the history of Iraq, if we could just pull back and look at the big picture for a second. What are some of the ways in which the world was changed by the Paris peace talks of 1919?
Well, I think you're absolutely right to want to pull back because the creation of Iraq took place in a much wider context. And in fact, it's not just the context of 1919. It's the context of the First World War, the War of 1914 to 1918, and even further back, the context of what was happening to the Middle East in the 19th century in the years leading up to 1914. So if I may, let me just say something briefly about that period before the war even started. Because what was happening, and the war was going to accelerate this, is that the Ottoman Empire, that massive Turkish Ottoman Empire, which was based around Istanbul, but which had in its time included a great deal of the Balkans, which had still, before 1914, ruled over a great deal of the Arab Middle East, that empire was declining. In fact, it was known to other European powers as the sick man of Europe in the 19th century. And as it declined, bits of it were breaking off. Peoples within it, like the Serbs and the Albanians, were seizing the chance to make their own states and become independent. As it was declining, you had, as of course would almost inevitably happen, you had outside powers looking at it with great interest to see what they could pick up as the Ottoman Empire looked in the process of disintegrating. And so before the First World War, you had Russia, for example, extremely interested in the whole area, because one of the long-standing Russian dreams was to get its fleet out through the straits, which the Ottomans controlled, from the Black Sea into the Mediterranean. You had the French very interested, because the French had historical and religious ties with parts of the Middle East. You had the British extremely interested, because the British had an empire in the Far East, in the East, which included, of course, India, the jewel in the crown. And the way that the British got out to India by the 19th century was through the Suez Canal, which runs through Egypt. And so you had a number of outside powers, Germany also very interested, looking at the Ottoman Empire, beginning to get involved, beginning to acquire influence and beginning to sort of stake out claims. And so what the war does is really speed up that process of disintegration. It encourages the various subject peoples of the Ottoman Turks, the Arabs, of course, to feel that they might have their independence sooner rather than later. By the time that war ends, the Ottoman Empire is indeed on the process of on the edge of disintegration. The Arab territories of the Ottoman Empire have basically gone. They have been occupied by largely British troops, and it looks quite clear that they're not going to go back to the Ottoman Empire. And so by 1919, when the peace conference opens in Paris, you have a situation in the Middle East which a lot of people are looking at with great interest.
One more thing before we talk specifically about Iraq. Just give us a sense of how the map of the Arab world was redrawn by the victors of World War One.
Well, the map of the Arab world actually had to be drawn, because what the Arab world had largely been, that those bits that were under the Ottoman Empire, and that included present-day Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Jordan and Israel, there weren't borders within it, there weren't countries within it. It was a collection of provinces that belonged to the Ottoman Empire. And so when the powers met in Paris to decide what to do with the Arab territories which had been taken from the Ottoman Empire, they had to decide what countries to make. And they literally just sat there around the maps and said, okay, you can have this bit, we'll take that bit. And they created these new countries.
Now, during World War One, the British had encouraged the Arabs to start a nationalist movement and rise against the Ottoman Empire, which controlled the Arab world, to fight for Arab independence. What were the British reasons for trying to organize this Arab nationalist movement?
Well, the British tried to organize an Arab nationalist movement, not, I think, because they were deeply sympathetic to the cause of Arab nationalism. I mean, there were individual British like T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, and Gertrude Bell, the extraordinary Englishwoman who helped to create Iraq. I mean, they did care about Arab nationalism, and they cared about the Arab cause. But the British government really looked at the Arab Middle East in terms of the war effort. And what the British government was very, very worried about was that the Ottoman ruler, the Sultan, who was also caliph, which meant that he was also spiritual leader of the world's Muslims, would declare a holy war against them. And that really sent shivers down the spines of both the British and the French, because they had a great many Muslim subjects in their empires. And if all those Muslims had heeded the call for a holy war or jihad, which the Sultan did in fact issue, then they would have had real trouble. So that was one reason why they wanted to weaken the Ottoman Empire as much as they could by encouraging the Arabs to revolt. What the British were also very concerned about was that the Ottoman Empire would attack into Egypt and disrupt the Suez Canal. And since that was Britain's lifeline out to its colonies, including, of course, India, in the east, that would have been very, very serious indeed for the British war effort. And so when the British government encouraged an Arab revolt, it was doing so very much in terms of something that would help the British war effort.
This is where T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, comes in. What was his role in trying to create this nationalist movement, this Arab uprising?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. T.E. Lawrence himself later on wrote his memoirs, and you would have thought from those that he pretty well did it single-handed, and I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, he was someone who had an immense sense of his own importance. His role was a liaison officer, and he was sent by the British to work with the leader of the Arab revolt, Prince Faisal. There was no ruling family in the Arab world, but there was a very distinguished family, the Hashemite family, who were traditionally guardians of the holy places in Mecca and were descendants of the Prophet himself. And so they had tremendous sort of spiritual and spiritual authority in the Muslim world. And Prince Faisal was the son of the Sharif of Mecca. And so he led the Arab revolt, and Lawrence worked very, very closely with him.
What were some of the difficulties of starting a nationalist Arab movement? Had there been an Arab identity before, or were the identities more tribal?
It's a very interesting question, and I think it's a difficult one to answer. There had been an Arab identity in the past. I mean, in the great glory days of the 8th and 9th centuries, there had been an enormous Arab empire which had stretched, you know, across North Africa and right across to the borders of Persia. And Arabs tended to remember that. I mean, there was great pride in Arab civilization. But it really was, I think, very difficult in 1919 to talk of a sort of international Arab identity. Arabs tended to be very particularistic. They were attached to their cities, to their tribes, to their own peoples. And in the case of Egypt, certainly, you had peoples who, yes, were Arab, but were also Egyptian. And the Egyptian identity perhaps was even more important than the Arab identity.
Do you know what Lawrence did to try to encourage Arabs to fight against the Ottoman Empire?
Well, what Lawrence did was basically promote a policy that the British were promoting. I mean, the Arabs rose up against the Ottoman Empire because they'd been given a promise. And the promise was in the form of letters from the British High Commissioner in Cairo, Sir Henry McMahon, to the Sharif of Mecca, to Hussein, the father of Prince Faisal, who led the revolt. And what the letters said in rather vague terms, and this was going to cause trouble later on, that if the Arabs lead a revolt against the Turks, there will be either an independent Arab state or independent Arab states. And so the Arabs in the revolt, and by no means all Arabs got involved, but a significant number did, the Arabs who took part in the revolt had every reason, I think, to feel that they had been promised Arab independence after the war was over.
Were the Arabs in Paris to make their case at the peace talks after World War I?
Yes, Prince Faisal came to Paris as the representative of the Arabs, or at least some of the Arabs. The authorities in Paris, the peacemakers, would not let him call himself the leader of all Arabs. He came representing the Hejaz, the bit of what is today Saudi Arabia that his own father ruled over. But he certainly spoke in the name of all Arabs. He appeared before the most powerful part of the peace conference, the Supreme Council, and looking very dramatic, wearing long white robes with a sort of wonderful sword, and made a speech in Arabic, which Lawrence actually translated for him. And the speech, as translated, said, you know, we must have an Arab independence, we must have our own kingdoms, we must restore the past glories of the Arabs. It is said by someone who was there who spoke Arabic that Faisal was actually just reciting the Quran and Lawrence was extemporizing and basically presenting the Arab case, which might have been true. I mean, Lawrence knew what the Arabs wanted. He and Faisal were very close. And so Faisal really staked out a claim for independent Arab states. There was not sympathy all around the table in Paris. Neither the French or the British wanted to see all of the Arab Middle East under independent Arab rulers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Margaret McMillan. She's the author of the new book, Paris 1919, about the peace treaty after World War I, which changed the map of the world. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is historian Margaret McMillan. Her new book, Paris 1919, is about the peace agreements made in Paris after World War I that changed the map of the world. As you were describing, the British promised the Arabs during World War I that if the Arabs revolted against the Ottoman Empire, that when the war was over, assuming the British and their allies won, that the Arabs could have their own state, their own independent state. But when the war was over, that's not quite how it turned out. How did the British evaluate whether to really follow through on this promise that they had made?
Well, what the British seem to have been thinking, and part of the trouble with the promises that were made was that the British government had many different departments, and so the promise to the Arabs really was made by people in Cairo. I mean, yes, they checked back with London, but at the same time, the people in London were also dealing with other aspects of the Middle East and doing other deals. What the British seem to have thought is that they would continue to control the bits of the Middle East that they particularly wanted, but that they would have nominally independent Arab rulers. And this was a pattern the British had used elsewhere. They'd used a pattern, for example, of indirect rule in Africa, where they had supported local African rulers who had ruled apparently independently but had basically taken advice from the British. And what the British seem to have thought, particularly those setting the overall policy in London, is that they could find some nice Arab rulers who would rely on British advice, follow what the British wanted to do, but would save the British the trouble of ruling these areas directly themselves. And so I don't think there was any intention on the part of the British, and certainly not on the part of the French, to have genuinely independent Arab rulers. That was not what they wanted.
Now, in your book, Paris 1919, you quote Prime Minister Lloyd George, and you say that he was intoxicated by the possibilities of the Middle East, a restored Hellenic world in Asia Minor, a nice Jewish civilization in Palestine, protection for Suez and all the links to India, loyal and obedient Arab states along the Fertile Crescent, protection for British oil supplies in Persia. This is a quote from the Prime Minister, Lloyd George. What was this? What were the possibilities the British saw for the Middle East? I mean, there was a vision they had in mind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Middle East tended to intoxicate outsiders. I mean, Napoleon had the same thing. I mean, he went to Egypt in the beginning of the 1790s and then had these dreams of suddenly being another Alexander the Great and building a great Asian empire. And I think there was something about it. It was partly the history. You know, it was so old and all these civilizations. I mean, this was fascinating. And Lloyd George, like a lot of leaders at the time, had grown up on the Bible. And so the whole idea of you know, having some influence over the holy places, I mean, this was also important. But really, when you got right down to it, I mean, these were pleasant dreams. Well, what really drew the British into the Middle East was their own interests, protecting Suez and the routes out to India. They also thought that the new way of traveling by air was going to be very important, linking up India with Europe. And they were going to need airfields going through the Middle East to get them out to India. And so that was now going to be very important. And oil was becoming a factor. The British Navy had switched to burning oil just before the First World War, and so secure sources of oil now became very important. Now, there was oil in Romania, and the British got some oil from there, and they got some from Russia. But, of course, that wasn't going to be possible, at least for a while, after the Russian Revolution of 1917. They had begun to develop the oil in Iran, what in those days was called Persia, but they suspected, and a couple of people had actually done some surveying, they suspected that in the north of what became Iraq, in and around Mosul, there was a very good supply of oil. And so really for strategic reasons to do with India and oil, the British were determined that they should have control over as much of the Middle East as they wanted.
Did the nationalism, the Arab nationalism, that the British had helped create backfire against the British when the British assumed control over parts of the Arab world?
Well, it's a very good question, and yes, it did. I mean, the Arabs had every reason to think that Britain and France had promised them independence. And in fact, just at the end of the war, Woodrow Wilson, of course, the United States had entered the war in 1917, and Woodrow Wilson, the American president, had made a lot of statements about national self-determination. And these had resonated in the Middle East. I mean, actually, Lawrence and Faisal and various others sat around the campfires in the desert and talked about Woodrow Wilson's promises of self-determination. And just at the end of the war, in November 1918, the British and French actually issued a declaration saying how they had always really hoped that the Arab parts of the Ottoman Empire would become independent and autonomous. And so the British did a lot, and so did the French, to encourage the Arabs to believe they were going to get their independence. And the Arabs were becoming uneasy because some of the secret deals that the British and French had been making were now beginning to leak out. And they became more than uneasy in 1919 and 1920 because the British and the French made it quite clear that even in the areas that were going to be nominally independent, Syria in the case of the French and Iraq in the case of the British, that the rulers were going to be handpicked by the British and the French and they were going to do what they were told. And you got a great sense of betrayal in the Arab world, which has never really gone away. I mean, you know, people do remember injustices that were done to them. And one of the things that a lot of people in the Middle East remember is this promise of independence, which was then snatched away from them.
When you say that the independence was nominal, Iraq became a British mandate under the League of Nations. What was the meaning of a mandate? What was the difference between Iraq being a mandate or Iraq being, say, annexed by the British?
Yeah, well, mandates were given out by the new League of Nations, which was formed, of course, very much at the prompting of Woodrow Wilson, the American president. And what a mandate assumed was that some nations were more developed than others, and that the more developed nations should take under their wing the less developed nations until those less developed nations were ready to stand on their own feet. And the League gave out mandates to rule over some of these less developed nations to countries such as Britain and France. And so that's what a mandate meant. It was an interesting idea, and it did actually introduce an element of responsibility that the mandatory power, say Britain, did actually have a responsibility to the mandated territory and actually had to report annually to the League of Nations on what it was actually doing there. So it is a step away from the old-style imperialism of the 19th century. And so the British adopted the language of mandates, but really, when they talked among themselves, they said, look, we can call it mandates, but basically it will be an old-fashioned sort of colony. Or perhaps what was closer was something, there was always a thing they had in between a colony, which you ruled directly and sort of took responsibility for, and a protectorate. It was a wonderful 19th-century term where you protected a smaller nation against whoever. And protectorates were rather looser forms of imperial control. It wasn't like running a colony, a protectorate. You generally left the local rulers in place, but you ran their foreign policy and you ran their defense policy. You made sure that no one else came in and took them. And so what the British really, I think, were thinking of in the case of Iraq, for example, was that a mandate would be very much like a protectorate. But they would, in all important aspects, determine the policy of the country they were protecting. And so when they set up the state of Iraq, which was a British creation, they made sure that they would control things like its foreign policy and defense policy.
No, so the idea of a mandate was that this country wasn't ready to rule itself yet, so there'd be a transition during which the British would accept some responsibility for ruling and help the people who were leading Iraq, but it implied that it was a transitional period. Was there a timetable or any way of determining when the British were supposed to end that relationship and give Iraq its independence?
Well, there were various assumptions that were made. It was assumed, it's interesting that all of the areas of the world that needed mandates, so was assumed in 1919, were the non-European areas. In fact, at one point someone said to Woodrow Wilson, you know, what about all these peoples who are suddenly cast adrift in the center of Europe because the Austro-Hungarian Empire has disappeared? And Wilson said, no, we can't have mandates for Europeans. And so what's built into the whole notion of mandates is that these are somehow inferior peoples in the non-European parts of the world. But they did make distinctions between those peoples who were closer to being ready for self-government, and the Arabs were counted among those, and they were subjected to what was called an A type of mandate, where they would have a relative degree of self-government, and it was expected that they would become independent. Not in any clear, there was no clear timeline for this, but it was expected they'd become independent in a generation or two. And the people who would decide whether they were ready for independence would be the League of Nations, which, of course, was dominated by European powers. And then there were other peoples in the South Pacific, for example, or in Africa, who were felt to be much further away from being able to rule themselves. And it was believed that the mandates over them would last very much longer and a lot more would have to be done for them.
Margaret McMillan is the author of Paris 1919, 6 months that changed the world. She's provost of Trinity College and professor of history at the University of Toronto. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands, a novel set in 1951 Florida at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement by Susan Carroll McCarthy. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Music from the soundtrack of Amandla, a documentary about protest music in South Africa during the apartheid years. Coming up, Milo Miles has a review, and we continue our conversation with historian Margaret McMillan about her book Paris 1919. Salam, salam. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with historian Margaret McMillan, author of Paris 1919, about the Paris Peace Treaty, which redrew the map of the world after World War I, creating many new countries, including Iraq. The League of Nations also came out of the peace talks. The League made Iraq a British mandate, giving the British authority to govern the new country until it was ready to govern itself. So Iraq became a mandate of the British, but the whole concept of Iraq was created by the British. The borders were drawn by the British, and the borders included many different groups with different allegiances, the Kurds, the Shiites, the Sunnis, Christians, Jews. Did the British take that into account, that there were that there were a lot of different groups that would have to be held together under the umbrella of one state?
There were some British who were very worried about it and who felt they were creating something that wasn't going to work terribly well. But, you know, when you think of the sort of people who were doing it, they had tremendous self-confidence. They thought they could manage it. Very, very interesting woman, Gertrude Bell, who had traveled widely through the Middle East before the First World War, knew the Arab world very well indeed, spoke Arabic and had a great many friends in Iraq. And she believed that, you know, really the capacity of the British to help to shape things was very large, and she thought the Arabs would listen. And I think she had some reservations about what was being created in Iraq, but not all that much. And she was, I think, in some ways quite typical. I mean, there were people who complained. Kim Philby's father, the famous British spy, Kim Philby's father, St. John Philby, was working in Iraq at the end of the First World War, and he did complain, and he did say, we're making a mess here, and he basically was fired and left the service.
How were the borders of Iraq drawn up?
They were drawn to suit the British, and that really is the long and short of it. What Iraq consisted of, or came to consist of, was three former provinces of the Ottoman Empire. If you go from south to north, these were Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul. The truly Arab parts of Iraq are really the parts south of Mosul. I mean, if you look at the population map, it's really the Arabs are concentrated to the north of Baghdad and then further south. And that would have made a workable Arab state. It still would have had significant minorities such as Persians and Jews, but it would have been a more predominantly Arab state. But the British wanted to put Mosul in, which, of course, contained a great many Kurds, partly because they didn't want the French to get it. France and Britain were allies in the First World War and had been allies since the beginning of the 20th century, but it was a very, very new friendship. They'd spent a lot of their history fighting each other, and they really didn't trust each other, particularly when it came to places like the Middle East. The British did not want the French to get Mosul. They didn't want to leave it with Turkey. They didn't want, you know, a bigger Turkey than there was. And so the British took Mosul. There was some talk, very vaguely, of having an independent Kurdistan, but in the end it was decided not to do that for various reasons. And so they basically put Mosul into the mix with Baghdad and Basra and drew a border around it, and they called it Iraq, which means the well-rooted or the well-founded country, which is ironic in view of what happened later on.
What did the British do to try to encourage a new identity, the identity of Iraqis?
Well, I don't think they really did all that much to encourage it. In fact, what the British seem to have done is really fostered an Arab identity, and in particular a Sunni Arab identity in Iraq. The old dominant classes in Iraq had been largely Sunni Arab, although the Sunni Arabs were a minority in Iraq, and the British tended to rely on them. And to rule over Iraq, they brought in an outsider. They brought in Faisal, actually, who had led the Arab revolt in the desert with Lawrence, and Faisal became king of Iraq. He did not have strong support in Iraq, didn't have strong roots, but the British felt they owed him something, which of course they did. One of the problems for Iraq has always been, and I think it's probably still an issue today, was Iraq part of a wider Arab world? And among a lot of Arabs, I think this is true, particularly of the Sunni Arabs, there really was a longing for one great big Arab kingdom to resemble the great Arab kingdom of the 8th and 9th century. And that's been a problem for Iraq, because there have always been those in Iraq who said, we're not just part of a wider Arab world, there is something called Iraq. And that's a very interesting idea, that Iraq is not Arab and not Sunni Arab and doesn't belong to a wider Arab world, but Iraq is Iraq, and Iraq is Iraq because it is cosmopolitan, because it does have Kurds, because it does have Shias, because it does have Persians. And there has always been a tension in Iraq, and perhaps it's still there even at the present, between those who look to a wider Arab world and those who try and create an Iraqi citizenship.
In 1920, the Iraqis rebelled against British rule. What incited that rebellion?
I think the rebellion was incited by a number of things. And it wasn't directed, I think, in any way. It wasn't directed particularly against British rule. I think a lot of it was directed against any rule. A lot of the rebellion was about not paying taxes. One of the things the British did, of course, was hope that Iraq would pay for itself. And so the British military occupation began to collect taxes in a rather efficient way, and that caused a great deal of resentment. And so a number of the great tribal confederations up and down the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates rose up against the British. Kurds in the north rose up because they didn't want to be part of an Arab-dominated country. And you got people in the south rising up again because they simply didn't like what was happening. So it wasn't really a coordinated move against the British. I think it was just resistance to the imposition of an alien rule, which was doing things that people didn't like.
What was the British response to the rebellion?
The British response to the rebellion was pretty ferocious, actually. The British government was under real pressure to cut costs, and so they didn't want to use troops if they didn't have to. And they were stretched pretty thin at that point because they were dealing with real troubles in Ireland and in India and in Egypt. And so what they tried to do was use new technology. And the new technology they had at hand were aircraft. And so they used the Royal Air Force. I think it's the first time in history that an air force was used primarily against civilian targets on the ground. And they used the air force to strafe villages that were rebellious to bring them into line. At one point, Winston Churchill, who was by then colonial secretary, actually contemplated using some leftover stocks of poison gas from the First World War. He didn't do that, but the British certainly did use their aerial power.
So what were the results?
Well, the results were that the rebellions were put down, and Faisal did indeed become king. But it wasn't a happy country that the British were ruling over. I mean, there were a lot of people who resented both the British presence and Faisal. And Faisal, of course, was seen as someone the British had put in there. He was seen as a British stooge. And there were all sorts of people. I mean, there were people who had had status under the old Ottoman Empire who no longer had that status. There were disgruntled army officers, disgruntled civil servants. There were religious leaders who regarded the British as irreligious. There were Kurds in the north who didn't really much care for the British rule. And so the British found that what they had thought would be basically a convenient way to run Iraq, and they could run it on the cheap and it would be easy, was never as easy as they thought. What they also found was that Faisal, who they had assumed would be so grateful to them that he would always do what he was told, was in fact very difficult indeed. I mean, Faisal had his own ideas. He was a very clever and a rather forceful man. And Faisal wanted to be independent. And so Faisal pushed and chafed against British dominance until finally in 1932, the British, I think it was 1932, the British had to sign a treaty giving Iraq virtual independence.
So in 1932, was the British leadership or the British public happy to have ended that relationship with Iraq and happy to be free of that responsibility?
Well, I think what happened to Britain during the First World War is that economically its position in the world began to weaken. I mean, it had been the leading economic power in the world before 1914, but it really was beginning what was to be a fairly slow process at first of decline economically. And the British government was finding it increasingly hard to pay for the empire. I mean, the empire was very big and very expensive, and bits of it didn't pay for themselves by any means. And, of course, what Britain had done was take on even more responsibilities in the Middle East in between the wars. And so the British government was constantly scrambling, and the Treasury, the sort of arm of the British government, which looked after government spending, was constantly complaining and constantly saying, we just cannot afford this. And so the British, I think, were beginning to find that the burden of empire was really too much for them. And remember, of course, by 1932, the Depression was in full swing. The British tax base was shrinking. There was tremendous unemployment in Britain. And that was a problem as well. And I think also by 1932, the whole attraction of empire was really beginning to wane. You know, the whole enthusiasm for empire and the self-confidence which had sustained the British when they'd built and managed an empire in the 19th century was beginning to go. A lot of people were beginning to say, is it worth it? A lot of them on the left, but not just on the left, on the right as well.
My guest is Margaret McMillan, author of Paris 1919, 6 months that changed the world. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Margaret McMillan. She's the author of Paris 1919, about the Paris peace talks after World War I that changed the map of the world. I'm sure you've been following the war in Iraq and its aftermath with great interest. What are some of the lessons you think the United States and England should learn from the history of Britain and Iraq in the teens and 20s?
Oh, I know lessons of history are always tricky, but I think they give us warning. And I think perhaps the parallel that might be drawn, or the one that the present administration of the United States might want to be aware of, is that the British thought, when they set up the new state of Iraq, that it was going to be easy to manage, it was going to be cheap, and they weren't going to have much trouble with it. And it seems to me that the present administration is perhaps assuming the same thing about Iraq today, that they can run it pretty easily, they won't have to stay there very long, they can turn over to a functioning government, which will, however, remain friendly to the United States. All the statements coming out of Washington today, you know, the sort of statements that will only be there for perhaps 18 months, perhaps even less, that seems to me to have an uncanny parallel with what the British were saying, not in terms of time, but just in terms of ease. You know, we can go in, we can set up this country, and then we can guide it more or less from a distance. And I think the British were going to find out that it was much more difficult than they had thought. And I wonder if the present administration may find that Iraq is more difficult to manage than they thought.
Iraq has always been held together either by the British or by a king or by a dictator. There's never really been democracy in Iraq. If there is a successful transition to democracy, are you reasonably confident that the country would hold together, or do you think that it would be factionalized, that there might even be some kind of civil war or at least some kind of bloody power play between different special interest groups within the country?
The danger, I think, in Iraq is that you will get civil war or conflict between different groups vying for power. And Iraq has been through a dreadful period, which has left a lot of its population, I think, brutalized. But, you know, I think there are signs of hope. Iraq has never had a fully democratic government, but it did have in the past elements of democracy. And there are levels of democracy. But what Iraq had in the past was, at times, a relatively free press, at times, relatively free public discussions. It did have political parties which debated with each other, which had different ideologies. It did have, at times, an orderly transition in government. And what seems to me also encouraging is that you did have in the past, and I think it's still there today, those Iraqis who say, we are Iraqi. We're not Shia, we're not Sunni, we're not Arab, we're not Persian, we're not Kurd. We belong to this multicultural, multi-faith state called Iraq. And a lot of Iraqi intellectuals, some of whom, alas, were killed by the Saddam Hussein regime or were forced into exile, have written about this and have tried to foster this. And it seems to me that those are hopeful signs, that there were moments in Iraq's past when there were at least some of the elements of what we think of as democracy, and that there is some evidence, I think, that a truly Iraqi citizenship can be built, that there's already the beginnings of that.
I'm going to shift the subject a little bit. Leaders around the world have made a connection between what's happening now in Iraq and the future of the Israelis and Palestinians. And everyone seems to see some connection. The disagreement is over exactly what the connection is and what the right thing to do is. You trace that connection back to the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, which not only created the new nation of Iraq, it created Palestine. And you think that the creation of Palestine was part of the larger betrayal that Arabs felt when the Arab world was carved up. The British made promises to Zionists and they made promises to Arabs, and those promises were contradictory. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I think the historical connection between what's going on in Israel today, between Jews and Arabs, is a very important. That historical connection to the wider Arab world is an important one. And it is one that is very much present in the minds of many people in the Middle East, and that's why we simply have to deal with it today. The British during the First World War were, on the one hand, making this quiet deal with the French to carve up much of the Middle East between their two nations. They were also promising the Arabs independence. Now, what that meant exactly has remained a matter of some controversy ever since, but promises were made, which the Arabs took seriously. At the same time as they were doing this, the British were also throwing their considerable prestige, remember Britain was the most powerful country in the world at this point, their considerable prestige behind the idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. During the First World War, the British government issued what came to be known as the Balfour Declaration. It was a letter written by the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, to Lord Rothschild, who was a leading British Jew. And the Balfour Declaration said that the British government looked with favor upon the establishment of a Jewish home in Palestine. And Palestine was a province, rather quiet and an undeveloped province in those days, of the Ottoman Empire. And so this was a promise made for when the Ottoman Empire should have disappeared. The wording was very carefully done. It said home, not state or not nation. But in fact, everybody knew at the time, the declaration was issued in 1917, everybody knew at the time, at least in the know in London, that this was the foundation of a future Jewish state. I mean, the Zionists who had been pushing for it certainly took it to mean that, and so did newspapers like the Times of London. I mean, when they had headlines saying Jewish state approved in Palestine. Now, where the Arabs come into this is the Arabs, not right at the time, but later on, pretty soon after the war ended, said, wait a minute, Palestine is ours, it's Arab, and it was largely Arab, it was at least 9/10 Arab in population in those days. It is surely part of the territory that we were promised would be an independent Arab state. What are the British doing? They are taking what we thought was our territory, and they're handing it over as a homeland to people who come from outside, which a lot of the Jews did. And when you also got this sense of betrayal that the Arabs felt they had been promised independence and then didn't get it or didn't get true independence, it was not only resulted in the Arab world or many people in the Arab world feeling resentful towards Britain and France for this act of betrayal, but they came to focus on the Jewish presence, the growing Jewish presence in Palestine, as a symbol right there at hand of that betrayal. And as Palestinian Arabs, the local Arab population of Palestine, began to react, in some cases with hostility to the Jewish presence, there began to be riots, and the Palestinian Arabs themselves began to organize and to demand their own rights, their cause became part of a cause in the wider Arab world. And so really right from the end of the First World War, you get this sense of betrayal in the Arab world at the great Western powers of Britain and France getting tied up with the growing Jewish presence in Palestine. And that's why the conflict from that point onwards has not just been a conflict between Jews and Arabs in Palestine or Jews and Arabs in what is today Israel. It's been a conflict which has drawn in the attention of the wider Arab world because they see it as, I think, still very much a symbol of the way in which, as they see it, they've been pushed around and manipulated by outside powers.
So that connection dates back to the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, that connection dates back a long way. And, you know, it's been used, of course, by Arab leaders. I mean, Saddam Hussein, who really, I think, didn't care much about the fate of the Palestinian Arabs in Israel, however, used it as a way to rally support in the Arab world for whatever it was he was up to. Nasser used to do the same thing in his time. I mean, it was a bit like all African nations being able to condemn apartheid in South Africa. It was the one thing they could agree on. And it was often a way of rallying the support of their own people. And I think it's been true in the Arab world. I mean, not all Arabs have been hostile to Israel. Not all Arab nations have refused to deal with Israel. But it has tended to be the sort of thing, and the fate of the Palestinian Arabs within Israel has tended to be the sort of thing that plays out very well in the Arab world.
When you started to write your book about the Paris peace talks of 1919 after World War I, did you have any idea how relevant the history was going to be?
No. No, I started to research my book in the 1980s when the Cold War was still on, and a lot of people thought it was a rather strange interest. I mean, why would you care about a peace conference which happened so long ago, which seemed to have so little relevance for the modern world? And I think it's partly the ending of the Cold War has made the world a much more turbulent and much more complicated place. We no longer have this great bipolar struggle between the Soviet Union and the United States. We have more complicated struggles, partly the breakup of countries such as Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, that have made people realize that how we got here is very important, and the histories of these parts of the world are very important. And so much of it can be traced back to the Paris Peace Conference. I mean, the Paris Peace Conference didn't cause the world's problems today, but in many cases, the threads go back there. And in many cases, issues we're dealing with today were being dealt with in Paris in 1919. And so I think the timing, from my point of view, it's not been great timing for the world, but the timing from the point of view of my book has been fortunate, because I think people are now much more interested in the history. And I think Iraq is the same. I mean, people, as you've been asking me, say, well, how did Iraq come to be? Why has it been such a country with such a turbulent history? And why is the conflict between Jews and Arabs in Israel somehow mixed in with all this? And to understand the answers to those questions, you really have to go back. And if you go back, you end up at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919.
Margaret McMillan, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Margaret McMillan is the author of Paris 1919, 6 Months That Changed the World. She's provost of Trinity College and professor of history at the University of Toronto. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews Amandla, the new documentary about black protest music in South Africa during the apartheid era. This is Fresh Air. The documentary Amandla and its soundtrack are both subtitled A Revolution in Four-Part Harmony. They describe how protest music functioned in the black communities of South Africa during the apartheid years. Archival footage, as well as interviews with poets, social activists, DJs, and famous performers such as Miriam Makeba and Nyu Masekela, put the old activist anthems into context. Critic Milo Miles says the movie tells not just about anti-apartheid songs in South Africa, but protest music in general.
Amandla, which means power, tells an undeniably inspirational story. Although apartheid begins in sorrow and blood, it ends in triumph with the return of Nelson Mandela and the fall of a racist system. Lee Hirsch's documentary shows how there were songs for every step of the struggle. It's history you can dance to. Although I wish there was a little more background about the tradition of a cappella vocal choirs in South Africa, Amandla gives fascinating information about how protest songs worked in that country. Many South African tunes have a joyous, upbeat quality. So in the early days of apartheid in particular, there would be numbers with a happy sound overlaying angry, even murderous content. The targets would not pay attention to the lyrics or even know the language. There's also the suggestion that songs are not really finished until they are performed by groups of people, taken into their lives and made weapons of resistance. How the people use a song and relate to it makes it whole. Finally, Amandla shows how protest sounds changed with the times. As armed resistance to apartheid and violent mass demonstrations became more common, songs started sounding less like catchy pop tunes and more like old Zulu war chants. The struggle against apartheid lasted more than 40 years. The movie's description of songs changing and growing in the community reminded me of the many recent articles about anthems, or the lack of them, either for or against war in Iraq. It seems to me that in a world of instant wars, we expect powerful instant music responses. But the results may be more like instant coffee, spindly and unsatisfying. As Amandla suggests, political tension has to go on and on, sink into the bones, before songs can emerge that will also sink into the bones. Fast-changing situations and mixed feelings do not strong anthems make.
Milo Miles is a contributor to Rolling Stone magazine. He's based in Cambridge. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Diane Ravitch, author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Children Learn. She says that textbooks have been censored by groups on the left and the right, groups which created an intricate set of rules designed to screen out language that might be considered offensive or controversial. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.